Welcome to another season of Poetic Principles. I'm Mary Flynn with New Virginia Review, and New Virginia Review, in a partnership with the Virginia Museum of Fine Arts, help me welcome Claudia Emerson.
Thank you. Thanks, Mary, for the introduction. And I'm going to start with Things from Figure Studies, which is my brand new book. It just came out. If you're familiar with my third book, Late Wife, that got so much attention, that book was very, very personal, emotionally exhausting to write. And when I was done with it, I decided to disallow the first person singular for an entire book, which is tricky to do. I thought I'm going to write nothing about myself, and I'm just going to exercise a different set of creative muscles. So I looked back into my life and went to something more imaginative. And I'm going to read some from the opening sequence of this book, which is called All Girls School. My experience with the All Girls School is having attended an All Girls Episcopal boarding school in my hometown. I was a villager. I was from down the hill, so I had a little different angle on the girls' school. And I paid a lot of attention in the 70s to what was going on. Then fast forward, I became the academic dean of that same girls' boarding school with my Master of Fine Arts degree in poetry, which made me, as I've said many times, stunningly unqualified to hold that position. I'm still very proud of the fact that I believe that school still has a nurse 24 hours a day. That was my mission. That school should have a nurse in the building 24 hours a day. This was after I spent many weekend evenings poring over a physician's desk reference, trying to figure out what some girl had mistakenly taken, thinking it was her whatever medication. Then I was also on the board of trustees of the same school for 6 years. So I had a lot of interesting meetings where they were talking about things of great concern to the school and I was taking notes for poems. Also, I taught for a while at Randolph-Macon Women's College, which is now Randolph College, and I currently teach for the University of Mary Washington, which had as its founding being all women. And you'll hear from some of the poems that even the architectures of girls' schools can be different. So this is the opening epigraph. It's a little bit long, so I'll read it really fast. But it's from Sir George Frazer's The Golden Bough, A Study in Magic and Religion, and it was published in 1923. Thus, the object of secluding women at menstruation is to neutralize the dangerous influences which are supposed to emanate from them at all such times. That the danger is believed to be especially great at the first menstruation appears from the unusual precautions taken to isolate girls at this crisis. Two of these precautions have been illustrated above, namely the rules that girls may not touch the ground nor see the sun. The general effect of these rules is to keep her suspended, so to say, between heaven and earth. Whether enveloped in her hammock and slung up on the roof as in South America, or raised above the ground in a dark and narrow cage as in New Ireland, she may be considered to be out of the way of doing mischief. Since being shut off both from the earth and from the sun, she can poison neither of these great sources of life by her deadly contagion. In short, she is rendered harmless by being, in electrical language, insulated. I found out jogging with the women's history professor at Mary Washington that Frazer made all that stuff up. And I decided even better then that people just simply believed it. Second epigraph is from Charlotte Bronte's Jane Eyre. Ranged on benches down the sides of the room, the 80 girls sat motionless and erect. A quaint assemblage they appeared, all with plain locks combed from their faces. Not a curl was visible. It suited them ill and gave an air of oddity even to the prettiest. The physical plant. Everything here measures. Weight, effort, sin, and everything costs in this seclusion of daughters. The place, an ark. Its hold all of a kind in archaic, combed order. Straightened teeth, trained spines, the chapel's benches in rigid rows before crimson kneeling pillows, slim beds in dormitories, the muted ticking of practice rooms, horses, stalls just mucked, the halls humid with breathing, and in the brushes, their hair, enough to line the nests of 100 generations of birds. in all those board meetings when they would talk about the health of the physical plant and all the buildings, and I thought, I think I can do something with all these adolescent girls wandering around in something called a physical plant. I'm glad you're laughing, because sometimes if anyone's read Late Wife and I read from those poems first, I can't get them to make the turn with me. That I actually did something a little bit wicked and had some fun thinking about the poems that way. So I think you'll appreciate the humor in a girls' school. Many of them are like this, claiming to be leadership programs for women, and all of the offices of leadership that they see are held by men. This one is called, then, Headmaster. He rocks up onto the balls of his feet, clears his throat to lead the assembly with a voice more familiar than their fathers, brothers, those distant as only kin can be. The girls surround him, the youngest sitting on the floor, close enough to notice in his loafers the clean, empty slits where the pennies are supposed to go. When I looked at a school as a metaphor or a figurative place for thinking about women and how women are taught to behave and be good, I looked at teachers, I looked at architectures, and I also looked at lessons. So this one is called The Girls Dissect the Eye of a Cow. I have to say it's also great fun to teach at a small liberal arts university where I can pick the brains of my science colleagues, and they tolerate me very well. This little odd poet who wanders around in the Jepson Science facility looking for metaphor. The students at Mary Washington that semester were dissecting the eyes of sheep, but I substituted cow because it fit better with the mission of the book. They gather around it, bored or enthralled in the aqueous chamber, center of the blind spot, pupil, iris. It has been released from its orbit, from the body's confinement, the sullen, perpetual cud, fence line, salt look, and sun, from long nights spent waiting in ruminant fog. They cannot reconcile themselves with this thing intent on them, whether eye of the wind, the needle, or heaven. I couldn't resist one for the Latin teacher. And actually, this one is a combination of memories from the girls' school Latin teacher that we all loved, named Mary Virginia Gillum, who was very, very Southern, so she's at the heart of this poem. But also there was a very mean English teacher. I guess if this is being recorded, I won't mention any names. But she really did make us eat everything with a knife and fork. But in the poem, it all goes for the Latin teacher. Seamed stockings, sensible shoes, cardigan buttoned all the way to the top, she greets each of them by name as they enter her classroom, rebellious, identical. They want Italian, French, a younger teacher, anything but this woman, fluent in a language that will not travel, the deep south of her vowels, slow as the minute hand on the grinding clock behind her. Her hair is braided and coiled, contained in a bun, substantial as a hornet's nest, ashen gray. But their mothers were also made to take it, translations all the more hated for being inherited. Then they are assigned to her table in the den of the dining room, where she directs them to eat even popsicles with a knife and fork. She serves fried chicken by inquiring if they prefer to walk or fly. And they learn to choose the leaner wing because they believe it pleases her. At Halloween, in the darkened gymnasium, beside the tub of water where girls bob for apples, she sits in a small booth to tell fortunes, peers into their palms, Esto Perpetua, whispering again and again the same lie of a life so long they don't listen, their attentions lost instead in the swung shock of her hair let down into luminescence, brushing the floor like a curtain just closing behind her. Esto Perpetua means she will live forever. I don't want to linger in the girls too long. Once I got obsessed with this project, I wrote 25 of these girls' poems. I think I could have written 150. Once I began looking around school for metaphor, it seemed to be everywhere. I taught for years at Mary Washington a lower level intro to lit course that carried the environmental awareness designation. We've changed the gen ed since then, but I really did believe that studying the environment, reading about the environment, caring about it could happen in the humanities just as well as in the sciences. And so I read this essay at some point about the right whale, and the poem tells you what the girls will learn in their lesson about the right whale. But I was horrified to think that this giant creature was harvested all those years just for the stuff that would make corsets. Seemed all wrong. The whale was known as right because it was magnificent with oil, slow and easy to find and slaughter, floating even when dead. But after it was no longer needed for fat, men still hunted the whale for its rich mouth of baleen, harvested for hairbrushes, buggy whips, umbrella ribs, the stays of corsets, vain things designed to mold the female body, sculpt a waist so small a man's hands could meet with ease around it. Crazy, the girls agree, the way those women bought it. I think I'll read one more from the girls and then read some from the rest of the book because I do change point of view there. Some of you may have heard me read from these poems before they came out in the book, so I apologize if you've heard this little story before. But when I was the dean of the girls' boarding school, we had a natural gas leak in the building, and the headmaster was out of town, so I opted to evacuate all the buildings and pull the fire alarms, and everyone went out. And everyone did obey me, and they all went out front and lined up, except for a wonderful woman named Phyllis, who ran the switchboard, and she thought I was overreacting and refused to leave the building. So I was really worried about Phyllis, but I lined all the girls up. Later, I learned that had the gas leak been bad enough, I would have exploded the building because the bells were the old clapper kinds. I don't know if that was true. It's the volunteer fire department in Chatham, Virginia. But anyway, that's what they said. And then if I had exploded the buildings, I would have killed the entire student body because I had lined them up too close to the building. Thank goodness none of that happened. And the following year, I got my job at Mary Washington, where I don't have to make decisions about evacuating buildings. But I did write this poem thinking about those days. This one's a lot quieter than that. It comes toward the end of the sequence, and it's called Fire Drill. Bells sound them from sleep, and their imaginations rise, recite all they have been told, the curtains on fire, the beds, nightgowns, their hair, their hair. They've practiced this escape before, and know to close the windows last, descend the ringing flights of stairs in perfect wordlessness to line up barefoot on the dew-wet lawn, face the building, pretend to watch it burn. I decided in thinking about this book that I would explore a point of view I had not used before, having written so much in the first person singular. So I went to first person plural for two sections. One section I have women who are gossiping about other women. And those women they're talking about are women isolated by one thing or another. In this one, I call it Funny Valentine. The woman has simply opted out of the world and stays in her house most of the time. If you don't know the song Funny Valentine, here's a little bit of the lyric. My funny Valentine, sweet comic Valentine, you make me smile with my heart. Your looks are laughable, unphotographable, yet you're my favorite work of art. Is your figure less than Greek? Is your mouth a little weak when you open it to speak? Are you smart? And again, this is in the voices of women in a small town, this time the ladies in the garden club. She had been a late and only child to parents already old and set. None of us had ever wanted to go inside that hushed house and play with her, her room too neat, dull, crowded. We did encourage her later, though, to enter the high school talent contest after we'd heard her singing My Funny Valentine in a stall in the girls' bathroom, reckoning the boys would laugh, find us even prettier in comparison. Still, we would not have predicted those wisteria-scaled walls, the one room we could see from the street with its windows open year-round so that greening vines entered and birds flew in and out. Bad luck, we thought, bad luck. By then, we were members of the ladies' garden club, the condition of her house and what had been its garden, a monthly refreshment of disappointment. the most delectable complaint, her parents' last coup de ville, sinking in tangled orchard grass and filled to the roof, plush front seat and rear with paperbacks, fat, redundant romances she had not quite thrown away. Laughable, we laughed, unphotographable with wild restraint. That poem was inspired by some years of helping my dad read gas meters in my small town, and this one reclusive woman had that car in the back filled with all those paperbacks, and I wondered, why did she put them in the car? So I just made up the poem from that. Then I have children who narrate. Often the children are the wisest of us, I think, and they are seeing things that the gossips do not. There's a little epigraph from this section from one of my favorite books, Harper Lee's To Kill a Mockingbird. This is in the voice of Charles Baker Harris, little Dale Harris, who says, when he pops up out of the collard patch, he says, I'm little but I'm old. This one's about the cat lady. I started to write this poem, and I started talking about the cat lady in Chatham, Virginia, and everybody I mentioned it to talked about the cat lady in their hometown. So I realized that every town has one, I think. And that's why I opened with ours was a widow. I actually did a lot of research about that and found out that having too many cats is a different version of hoarding. And only they rotate around by themselves. You don't have to move them around like the newspapers. Cat lady. Ours was a widow, childless. We knew she wore that bathrobe in the daytime, smoked camels and drove the flat black Pontiac that had grown old with her. And we knew about the cats. When we came to deliver her groceries or rake leaves, we could see through her back door. They were perched on the pie safe, the refrigerator, the kitchen table, shadow, quiet, watchful as owls at dusk. And the smell was not just of cat piss and foul tinned fish, but of something more, the heat of cats yawning, an old woman's long and smoky hair. We could never describe it, and could not help imagining, out of that quiet, the sound of urgent nursing from glistening knots of newborn kittens, the wail and hiss of mating, dying, the beat of all those hearts. In the original version of that poem, what really happened was the men took that Pontiac after she died and they backed it up to the house and put a hose from the car into the house and gassed all the cats in the years before SPCAs existed. So I had that in the poem, and I had this whole thing about the cats going with her to the tomb, you know, and all this stuff. And my mentor and first reader, Betty Adcock, says, you've got too much burning up in this book. You've got to pull that out. So I just cut it off at the cats there. This is one that was set in Danville, Virginia in 1964, and I call it Elevator Operator. And it's inspired by a memory I have of being a little girl. We'd go to the big city of Danville to shop, and there was a Tallheimer's department store. I know some of you in the room are old enough to remember human elevator operators, and this one was a very small African-American woman, and I was amazed that she'd be calling out the names of the floors, but no one ever looked at her. They kept looking at the dial as though she wasn't sitting there. So the children are narrating this as well. All day she ferried them, almost all women, all white, as they rose to fall in strict passage, the gondola close to airlessness, curfew dark. She filled the forward corner, perched on a small fold-down stool from which she could reach with ease both the lever and the collapsing metal lattice of the door. All day she closed them in like perfumed birds, rustling nylons, shopping bags, purses, and released them again to the few destinations she had to repeat, announcing third floor, menswear, mezzanine, unseen steel cables controlling all of them in endless, storied looping. Only children saw her until most learned not to, looking up instead to the dial above the door, its face an eclipsed compass, the ornate brass needle of her voice, sweeping east to west to east by the northern route, as though the south were never there. Then I go in the final section of the book, I just go to some standalones where the character narrating is not in the poem. Read this one because a lot of you travel often or have traveled Route 1 between here or Point South. Route 1, in case you haven't been on it, was a main thoroughfare that was killed by the interstate. So this is set at the Route 1 flea market. If you've never been there, do not go alone. This poem was inspired by a little old woman who was very frightening. At the Route 1 flea market, inside makeshift stalls, hawkers slumped in resigned habit, their tables weighted down with everything broken, fans, dolls, blenders, clocks, all destined for the trash heap, suspended, spared, for at least one more late Saturday afternoon. To the side and behind them, a lone structure listed, small as a bedroom or a circus wagon stalled at the edge of a field, shrinking toward it. She was its door, set in the blank wooden frame, old, clearly, swaddled in blankets, mummy-like, diminishing inward as though packed with mud and lichen, her body given over to that kind of waiting. Three ragged X's, painted black on a cardboard sign, told what she was selling besides some chipped dishes and empty picture frames. Boxes of magazines and tapes surrounded her, crowding the shaded space of the room behind her. All of it handled, wound and rewound, all those dated, glossed bodies used past desire. Still, she'd gesture, call out when anyone wandered near. If there's one thing I can't never keep in here, it's them pictures. Fingering in her patient lap the small purse, its emptiness, worried soft. I think I'll read one more from this book and then maybe a couple of new ones. Mary has asked Kent and I to do a pretty bawdy country song, so I don't know if y'all are in the mood for that or not, but we'll see when we get there. This story, it's near the end of the book, it's called Great Depression Story, and it belongs to my father's oldest friend. He died before my father died, and Daddy told this story and said that Carlton White had actually committed this little crime that happens during the course of the poem. I always thought it was a very funny story in some ways and ominous in others, and as Daddy said and Carlton said, they wondered what the woman thought when she came back home. Great Depression Story. Sometimes the season changed in the telling, sometimes the state, but it was always during the Depression, and he was alone in the boxcar, the train stalled beneath a sky wider than any he'd seen so far, the fields of grass wider than the sky. He'd been curious to see if things were as bad somewhere else as they were at home. They were, and worse, he said, places with no trees, no water. He hadn't eaten all day, all week, his hunger hard fixed, doubled, gleaming as the rails. A lone house broke the sharp horizon, the train dreaming beneath him. So he climbed down, walked out, the grass parting at his knees. The windows were open, curtainless, and the screen door, unlatched, moved to open too when he knocked. He could see in all the way through to the kitchen, and he smelled before he saw the lidded pot on the stove, the steam escaping. Her clothes moved on the line for all reply. The sheets, a slip, one dress, washed thin, worn to translucence. Through it he could see what he mistook for fields of roses, until a crow flew in with the wind, sudden, fleeting seam. By the time he got back to the train, he'd guessed already what he'd taken, pot and all. A hen, an old one that had quit laying, he was sure she wouldn't have killed it. The train began to move then, her house falling away from him. The story ended with the meat, not quite done, but believe him, he ate it all, white and dark, back, breast, legs, and thighs, strewing the still warm bones behind him for miles. I don't get that many fan letters, but I had a really strange letter from a gentleman saying that he had read that poem, but he said, screen doors don't have latches. Very interesting critique. I thought, I guess that's right. I just made that up. I just put it in there. A couple of new things to show that we can settle in a writing project and then it's going to shift the context of our lives will shift and the work will turn its way. So I know I have writers in the audience. When I know I've got people working and have things in progress, I really like to share some things that are relatively new and doing something different. So as I told you a little bit ago, my father just died in May. He was 93. He lived a good life, but I can't help it. I'm compelled to write about him. But I just thought, I don't want to write about him, my father. I want to write about the state of being old, because I think people don't think about it. We think of it as something wrong, and it's not illness. It's what happens. So this one opens a short sequence. I won't read the whole thing, just to give a sampling of it, about my father as he got more still. He got quieter. The porch. This is not illness, not dying. This stillness, a changed way of being here on the porch. 93, my father sits much as he always sat, still recognizable as himself. Ball cap, the same. Rocking chair, the fly swatter, old defense he holds but will not now use. Its mesh, a small window screen, keeping nothing away from him. The wrens have chosen again the glazed clay bird bottle he hung close under the shadowy eaves, and have more quickly accepted him, his presence, so little to grow accustomed to, as they fly back and forth, above and around him, in ordinary industry. In their bills, pieces of straw, tufts of moss or spider's web, they pause now and then to light on the clothesline, the downspout, the back of his rocker. When one grips the bill of his cap the way it will in a few minutes land on the branch of the dogwood, I understand that although I am as still as he is, and that such concentration is its own disappearance, the birds sense the difference. His being, so fully formed, it has become an unquestioned part of the small landscape of their survival. This one is simply called I, the first person singular, because, as is true with a lot of older people, my father began to lose the ability to pick up the rest of a sentence, but he would continue to try to talk, and he would open a lot of sentences trying to say, I. We open a lot of sentences with the first person. The brain seizes on it, old familiar beginning of what he means to say, the rest of the sentence urgently close, utterly lost, the body of something dissevered from its head. So worrying the hem of his pajama jacket like a rosary between forefinger and thumb, he tries again and again, repeating the long, flat I, a needle deepening in the groove, until his voice registers something beyond grief, disbelief, the word having returned to pure vowel, sound, oblivious elegy. I suppose I shouldn't read the one that I was still making marks on as you were all wandering in. This one is close to the end of the sequence, and it's set in the long-term care facility. From the edge of his bed in the sill of a long afternoon, I look out at a wind too mean for April, the muted edge of weather worse somewhere wetting itself against the window. The trees struggle against it, a bird's flight, useless argument. People lean into and away from it, bright clothes blown tight against their bodies. His brief immersions ended, my father will not surface again from that other place. His being defined by cycles of anguished breathing, followed by the shallow and sparse phases of what appears to be sleep with agitation, the unconscious physical despair of nightmare, this dying like giving birth, the labor of it that long, intense, inexorable. He works his hands into a knot so cold and frozen strong I cannot undo it, the flesh eerily translucent, a tangible invisibility through which I see, as though through glass, clearly the thinning blue veins, the tendons course along the bone, the fact of the bone itself, undeniable beginning of seeing past this place, the shadows slant dissolving, the night shift coming on. Y'all want to hear a body song? Anybody in the mood for that? I'll just skip forward then to the poem that inspired the body song, which is a poem from Late Wife, which again if I prided myself on something in the writing of this book, which deals, if you haven't read it, in part with letters to an ex-husband. I was in a long marriage that dissolved finally. And this poem deals, I don't want to sound like I'm bragging, but I tried to be very restrained in the telling of this part of the narrative because it's not the most important part. But it's the other woman poem that happens early on, and then I don't talk about her anymore. So this opens that part of the book. It's in my voice addressing the ex-husband, and it's called Aftermath. I think by now it is time for the second cutting. I imagine the field, the one above the last house we rented, has lain in convalescence long enough. The hawk has taken back the air above new grass, and the doe again can hide her young. I can tell you now I crossed that field weeks before the first pass of the blade, through grass and briar's fog, the night itself to my thighs, my skirt pulled up that high. I came to what had been our house and stood outside. I saw her in it. She reminded me of me, with her hair black and long as mine had been, as she moved in and then away from the sharp frame the window made of the darkness. I confess that last house was the coldest I kept. In it, I became formless as fog crossing the walls, formless as your breath as it rose from your mouth to disappear in the air above you. You see, aftermath is easier, opening again the wound along its numb scar. It is the sentence spoken the second time, truer perhaps with the blunt edge of a practiced tongue. Well, you can get the guitar, Kent. I don't claim to be a great singer, because I'm not, but he's a really, really good guitar player. We wrote it together, actually, and you'll hear where I stole from the, I think, quietly reflective, soulful poem where I'm not angry at all. Really, we're not violent. Remember, the song is a fantasy. I don't know what I thought I'd see, but she reminded me of me, her hair long and black as mine had been, when I thought we'd never end. If I had a gun, I'd have shot her dead for looking like me when I still had time enough to turn my back on you. I confess I crossed the field that night, fog to my thighs in the pale moonlight. I stood outside what was our home, had to see for myself that I was gone. If I had a gun, I'd have shot her dead for looking like me when I still had time enough to turn my back on you. Now the band goes wild right here. I could have told her what she would not hear, could have showed her what it looked like from there, that it's a story with the familiar in a backward mirror of the same old sin. If I had a gun, I'd have shot her dead for looking like me when I still had time enough to turn my back on you. But I had no gun in my hand, no gun to my head. I just left her there the way I wish I had years ago. Turn my back on you. If I had that gun, I'd have shot her dead for looking like me when I still had time enough to turn my back on you. If I'd have had a sling blade, some call it a Kaiser blade, but I call it a sling blade. If I'd had my Girl Scout knife, nail file, I could have made do with dental floss. But I let her live. Thank you.